Well, that's a rather tall order, because it's something that many democratic societies have been debating for at least half a century. But let me say a few things that come to mind. So first of all, thank you both for putting the term power on the table. I used to say a few years ago that in my own dissatisfaction being in a place that calls itself a school of government, the Kennedy School, every year towards the end of the academic year, I would say to myself, why am I so dissatisfied? Why am I so dissatisfied? And each year I would say, well, it's because they don't talk about something. And in about my second year, I realized that they don't talk about power. They talk about policy, they talk about politics, but they don't talk about power. So it's something that I'm acutely conscious of, and thank you for bringing back to the front of the agenda. So there are, of course, many different ways to hook into that question. There are very locally specific responses that people have made to the question of technology and power. You may be interested, if you're a constitutional law expert, shall I say, in an article I wrote a number of years ago called In a Constitutional Moment, in which I specifically talked about how technology has a constitutional shaping effect, but without some of the safeguards that procedural safeguards, to pick up your point about procedure, that would accompany an actual constitutional convention. I mean, of course, in Europe, you're going through an, if in effect, long-drawn constitutional convention of a funny sort, and there are moments of debate and so forth. But a technological revolution that suddenly tells us we are networked with the spam producers of the world who can invade our mailboxes on a daily basis without us doing anything about it, that is a constitutional-like change, in a sense, about our accessibility and so on. But we have nothing to do with it, and we don't even understand the software that makes any of this possible and so on and so forth. So there's no question that technological innovations of a far-reaching sort, you know, the spread of DDT so that it's present in every woman's tissues and in breast milk. I mean, you know, if it had been somebody trying to inject you with something, you would have had, in American constitutional terms, Fourth Amendment rights against them and, you know, violations of common law assault and battery charges and so on and so forth. But you don't have any of that because it's just happened. You know, so I think recovering that sort of constitutional dimension of technological change is an incredibly important way to think about technology and its power in society, and then to ask these questions. So in a localized way, everything from science cafes to participant action research or action-oriented research are to some extent attempts to say, well, there should be at least a piece of scientific and technological activity that is coming from the bottom up, that is directly responsive to people's framing of their own needs and interests. Now, I think that that doesn't go far enough. For one thing, because the imaginations or imaginaries associated with those bottom up projects tend to stay at the bottom somehow. So it's like developing the smokeless chula or, you know, fireplace for people who it is imagined they will stay in their peasant condition. They'll just have smokeless ovens to cook with, or the waterless toilet. People will still stay poor, but they will have a waterless toilet. So what's not imagined is a far more grand and deep-going, thoroughgoing change in society that technology and science can somehow provoke. And so while you were talking, Piero, in particular, I was thinking about revolutionary imaginaries. And I am a child of the post-colonial era, and my parents were involved in the Indian independence movement. And in any case, I come from a place in the world that has Buddhism and Hinduism as some of its cultural and religious resources. And those, all those things, those religions and the social movements that produced decolonization, You know, when the West came to, well, Time magazine, a representative of Western thought, came to decide in the year 2000, you know, who the person of the century would be, the two people that came up were Einstein and Gandhi. And so it's sort of interesting to think about this in that sort of context. So those religions and those traditions have been about releasing the potential that's locked up in people, the democratic potential, at very modest levels and building up an aggregate, which is like revolutions and like social movements. So this is what Michael Hart and Antonio Negri write about when they talk about multitude the emergence of a constitutional order from the bottom up with these energies released in some way with, you know, maybe a neo-Marxist revolutionary impetus behind them. So I'm too much of a liberal constitutionalist to think that, you know, just left to its own devices, there's going to be this explosion of fervor and somehow the world that results will be better off. So the question is how to accept some of those ideas of bottom-up mobilization. I'm reminded of a poem that made a huge impression on me. I must have been under 10 because I remember reading it in Calcutta. It was written by Tagore, who was the great Bengali poet and also in his own way social activist of the pre-independence era. And it was about a famine in the land and the king not being able to do anything about it. I mean, one could contrast it with the story of Joseph and his dreams. But in any case, a woman Buddhist monk comes to the king and says, I am going to solve your problem. And she goes around with a begging bowl from house to house to house and collects the surplus from each house. She's not an economist. Tagore wasn't an economist. But he was talking about collecting the bits and pieces of surplus. It's the same imagination as the Grameen Bank, which has now become a revolutionary idea, even to the extent of getting the Nobel Prize. But you could think of those as being about imaginaries that unlock that democratic potential that's locked up in very tiny things, and then how to unlock it and make it possible. So it happens, of course, when there are great injustices like colonialism or slavery. But how to make it happen when there are little injustices, that's a problem, because revolutions like decolonization only happen, you know, once in an era and not all the time. So how to make those kinds of changes possible? And Maria Chiara, you were talking about law, and I think the law is an extraordinary site of reimagination, and one has to think of analogies. So the American class action, for instance, could be thought of as being like the Grameen Bank in its inspiration. The class action is a legal procedure which is not used in many other countries, and even in America it's always under siege from the right wing. But what it says is that individual people do not have a big enough stake to pursue an injustice even when an injustice has been done. But if you add up all the little stakes, you would get a big enough stake. And then if you also give an incentive to somebody to represent this, American lawyers get 30 to 40% of the cut if they manage to win. That's a big incentive. It doesn't have to be that big. But anyway, you can tinker with the incentive structures through the law in a way that allows the aggregation of these individual stakes and claims that are too tiny. People don't have the eloquence or the language to represent them on their own. So I think you can think of a set of analogies from decolonization to the Grameen Bank to class actions to participant action research and things like that, and just start building the cases. I mean, one of our problems in the academic world is that we do huge amounts of data collection that are quantitative and survey style, and they flatten differences, and they don't disaggregate cases and tell about the thickness, the situatedness, the detail of the narratives. But unless we have a lot of narratives in our heads, we're not able to make the creative analogies and to say, this is a model. Let's try it. I mean, after all, constructing imaginaries partly is a matter of digging into some unfamiliar territory and saying, let me import the conceptual structure of that thing to do this. Now, scientists, as Giuseppe, for instance, will testify, are very good at doing that in their own work. I mean, to some extent, you become, I mean, you know, these terms like German basteln or bricolage. I mean, it's about getting things from here and there and sort of reimagining the world that you're working in. As social entrepreneurs, I'm not sure we do that often enough. My school actually teaches social entrepreneurship, and I'm not sure what it teaches there. It certainly doesn't approach it from an epistemological standpoint. And I think we need to do that because we need to uncover this connection between knowledge and power, which is too taken for granted for anybody to question it anymore. So I think we have some critical thinking to do there. Now, for academic scholars, I mean, you know, many people in my own field say STS, Science and Technology Studies, has become irrelevant because it isn't directly going out there and changing the world and rechanneling power in some ways. But I personally would not be well suited to traveling India in the female equivalent of a loincloth, you know, getting people mobilized. That's just not where my talents lie. On the other hand, I can reveal through analysis and through the right kinds of storytelling certain problems that get in the way structurally and repeatedly of the sorts of mobilizations that you are interested in and that you want. So I think there are barriers to the mobility of ideas that don't get enough attention. I think we put a lot of attention onto the productive side of what we do, and we study productivity. We don't study unproductivity and where things don't move. So an example, I've been following the aftermath of the Bhopal gas disaster of 1984 for a very long time. And only recently has it become clear to me that innovation played in many different ways in that tragedy. So first of all, there was the technological innovation of the Green Revolution, which made India as a state decide that it needed pesticides, your pesticides, and generically speaking, I'm making the story relevant to you. I know they're not your best. Union Carbide's pesticide, okay? So India decided, without much awareness of what was involved, that it needed this technology, contracted with Monsanto. The Indian government knew to do one thing, which is not to allow majority control to Monsanto, so it took, you know, gave Monsanto 49.1% and took 50.9% itself, which turned out to be actually a bad mistake in legal terms. But in any case, what was not thought about is that Monsanto's technology was developed for a physical location and a population density that made large on-site storage of an extremely toxic ingredient not so dangerous. If there had been an explosion, nobody much would have been injured. At that same time, I believe BASF or Bayer, in any case, one of the major German companies producing the same stuff, Seven, but their technology for producing it did not have that on-site storage because, of course, in the European context, you're always dealing with population density and, you know, everything is urban and so you just don't have that. So this technology is now imported into India and it's put in a completely inappropriate place, a major city in India. And, of course, as soon as a plant comes, it becomes a magnet for economic activity and everybody comes. It gets even more densely populated. There is a disaster. Thousands and thousands of people die. Hundreds of thousands of people are injured, and you know, it's a catastrophe to end all industrial catastrophes in a sense. So it was a very low level of technological innovation that actually produced the pesticide in question. I mean, it wasn't a high-tech kind of thing. On the other hand, after the disaster happened, there was a very high grade of sociological inventiveness and legal inventiveness. So Indian lawyers who had never actually been captured by Western legal thought because they'd never dealt with something like this came up with a lot of doctrinal innovations that they thought would help the victims in that context. And none of those traveled outside India. So there was not a World Trade Organization like then to ensure that legal ideas would have no non-tariff barriers to trade imposed against them. So maybe you and the foundation can think of how to create the preconditions for something like the World Innovation Organization, which doesn't discriminate between technological objects and social objects of innovation, and ensures that the barriers to trade and ideas get reduced in the same way that barriers to trade and objects have been reduced. Now, of course, this is where power comes in, because the American court said, sorry, we have a doctrine, forum non convenience, and it says that the case should be tried where it's convenient. But how did the judge know what was convenient? That's a sociology of knowledge question. The judge simply knew that it was not convenient to try it. Not convenient for whom? You know, not convenient for him, of course. And, you know, the American lawyers who are arguing the case before him. So what somebody like me can do is point to the asymmetries of travel and mobility, of innovation in a case like that, and talk about how it is that one kind of innovation did travel and the other kind of innovation did not travel. And we can begin to think about institutional power, embedded power, structures of power that get in the way of this free circulation. And then we can also start thinking about a world order that is capable of organizing something like the WTO and saying, decreeing that people must buy into this. Our intellectual property ideas must be universalized. There's an idea that's a legal idea that has traveled and has become universalized, whether people like it or not. It's become universalized through TRIPS. So why is it that those legal ideas travel, but the idea of multinational enterprise liability that says a multinational corporation is like a small state and it should be held to the governance standards of states, that idea does not travel? So, you know, I can, as a critical scholar, make these arguments, tell the narratives, create the sort of parables of our time, but other people need to work to translate them into institutional action. So that brings me to the democratization of ignorance, which I think is a fantastic idea. And I think here I would link it up with my own thinking about what the sociologist Robert Merton said when he talked about the ethos of science. So back in 1942, when the world was looking at totalitarian controls on science, Merton, who was America's first and still perhaps foremost sociologist of science, said that science had made progress because it had certain ethical norms that scientists subscribe to, not because they're virtuous people, but because it's institutionally necessary for the production of good knowledge. And one of these norms he called organized skepticism, which was basically peer review, that scientists are in the business of continually checking each other's work because they have to take on trust what other people say, and they can only do this if there is an enforcement mechanism, you know, a kind of policing of the entire territory, so that by and large you can take on trust things that appear in the published literature. So I think that organized skepticism would be a very good normative commitment for democratic societies to have. That is, I think we should think about whether our institutions have organized skepticism built into them. I think for any robust institution, including the Catholic Church, you will find that there are rules of organized skepticism, but these are not immune to criticism. They should not be immune to criticism. And I think you will find that in all institutions as well, the rules of organized skepticism come to a stopping point of some sort. You were talking about stopping points before, that you can unpack this far. If you go further, then suddenly you're a disobedient person and you get read out of the situation in some way. So how to create a place for the disruptive person? I mean, you know, so as an analogy, you can think of the whistleblower in a large organization. We've actually said the whistleblower has a certain legally protected space because we've decided that as a large society, we benefit from some people operating as whistleblowers. I've known a couple of whistleblowers personally. They're awful people. You wouldn't want them to be your friends because they're constantly looking for trouble, you know, and you know, when you hear their life histories, they've just made one accusation after another. I mean, they're not typically people with long friendships and stable marriages. But nevertheless, as a social role, it's kind of important to preserve that space. Like the space for the inspired madman, who makes oracular pronouncements that may be wrong 90% of the time, but 10% of the time it's suddenly, you need exactly that kind of disruption. So how you achieve a sort of manageable, productive, sometimes uncontrollable form of organized skepticism at all of these different levels. Maria Carey, you were talking about different nested systems inside other systems. I think those are institutional design questions, and they're very, very difficult. But I think if all of us were aware at our fingertips all the time that organized skepticism, that skepticism, but kept within bounds, I mean, not a sort of endless deconstructive skepticism that leaves you nowhere, but a more productive skepticism that allows for learning, feedback loops, all these things that we know from systems analysis, how to achieve that and to integrate it within organizations. I suspect that the McKinseys of the world actually teach their consultants. I've never been fortunate enough to be close friends with a McKinsey consultant, but I suspect that that's the sort of thing they teach. And, maybe we have, as society, something to learn from those experiences. But generically, I think an answer is that organized skepticism allows the kind of questions to be asked that Hans Christian Andersen's little child asked about the emperor. Where are those clothes after all? Now, you could see the story as a parable, because that child was actually free from constraint by being a child. The courtiers were unable to ask it. So maybe those parables, how do you create the presence for the child, the mad person, the whistleblower in organizations? What are the suitable ones? And you can take any institution. I mean, we have a 9-member Supreme Court in America. Dissent is allowed, but the rules of legal interpretation say these 9 judges can write 9 separate opinions, but we won't actually listen to the dissents. On the day the decision is handed down, all that organized skepticism will disappear. We will only remember the holding in the case. So is that a good idea? I mean, how do we actually keep alive that skepticism to keep on working like yeast in a system? Now, in a legal culture, of course, you remember those dissents. And sometimes, as in the slavery cases, the dissent eventually becomes the law. It takes a long time for this to happen. But it is a way of preserving the alternative imaginary. It's a way of keeping a record of other imaginaries that were there. If you stifle dissent, if you never give it expression, then you, of course, don't have that. About the politics of innovation and working backward, I mean, again, a sort of big issue, and maybe I should stop and let you speak again. But I think that again, what I said before about looking at the barriers to politics is a place to begin. So intellectual property laws are an obvious place, because they in effect say that the innovative decision must be shielded off in certain ways in order for people to have a protected sphere for innovation. What that report was attempting to do, the Taking European Knowledge Society Seriously, was first of all to say that that is a very thin description of innovation, that innovation that does not take the user into account is not very helpful. People ask in a very puzzled tone, why is it that Nokia is successful and GMOs are not? Okay, so part of it is that certain kinds of technologies actually liberate the potential in the user to create new forms of life, to take that Wittgensteinian language. So repoliticizing innovation may be about, maybe a question about how do you set free the imagination in society or in the users to be able to do more with the technologies. On the whole, we know that technologies that come too packaged, too black boxed, that you can't do anything with, are not the ones that spread like wildfire. It's the ones that people can integrate. So the cell phone is a great parable of a technology that's managed to integrate itself into very different forms of life, from the very poorest to the very wealthiest. And partly people are doing different things with them that were not imagined. So in East Africa, I'm told that, you know, people it's like the Grameen Bank example, that people are engaging in all kinds of micro economically productive transactions by using the cell phone as a producer of information and, you know, a sort of creator of communication patterns between people who would not otherwise have been able to communicate at all. So sort of deep understandings of cases like that, of technologies that do take hold. The cell phone is interesting because it had been imagined in a sense before it was actually in play. And there's an interesting analysis of it that was done in the Cornell STS program in the early 1970s that predicted that personal communication systems would not succeed. It'd be interesting for a historian to go back and see why, in the imagination of those analysts, it was thought that it would not succeed. You know, what happened? Is it the lightness that came about? Is it that the world changed toward being a more individual-centered society? Is it that other forms of mobility were needed in order to make this mobility fruitful? I mean, you know, so what all happened? Long-durée stories, I think, those are a very important resource that we don't make enough of and should.